6 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today and tomorrow. Well, I just want to read a little bit of an excerpt from an article that appears in the Mercury News, a California newspaper, just to kind of set the stage for the rest of the hour's discussion. America's beef industry and federal agricultural officials spent much of the past week reassuring the public that the nation's meat supply is safe after the announcement that a California dairy cow tested positive for mad cow disease. So, are we doing an hour on mad cow? No, we are not. I want to make that very clear right from the start. What that story gave us was a launching point to talk about the bigger issue of food safety and where our food comes from. I know I don't spend an awful lot of time in the grocery store wondering where my lettuce has grown or how the meat gets to the meat department and so forth and all the various steps. We don't see all that. We don't see the sausage being made where we may be better off. Some aren't so sure. But thought today that it would be an interesting idea. We'll see how this works. To just talk about the food system, how the food gets to us, what are the policies and the politics of that, all sorts of things. This program may go all over the place, and we have two guests, so lots of opportunity for things to talk about related to our food supply. Let me introduce them to you first, and both of my guests are joining me by phone this morning. First, Bill Wienders, Associate Professor of Sociology at Georgia Tech University. He's the author of the book, The Politics of Food Supply, U.S. Agricultural Policy in the World Economy. Professor Wienders, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
And also joining me by phone is Elizabeth Ransom, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Richmond. Professor Ransom, good morning. Thanks
good
morning, for joining me. All right. Well, let's... Since meat was the jumping off point for the program, let's start with that. But I we're not going to spend all hour on it, and there's just so much to talk about. Let's talk about the safety of the meat that we get in the grocery stores and so forth. This latest story about mad cow there aren't very many dairy cattle going into the meat supply that shows up in your local store. But there certainly have been some issues with food safety related to beef and poultry, eggs, and so forth. And so we'll start with you, Professor Ransom. What about the safety of the meat products we buy and consume here in the United States?
Well, as you've sort of acknowledged, that's a big question. In general, obviously, our food supply is safe. I think in the case of this dairy cow, it's really about the issue of mad cow disease and how, for many people, it's a terrifying disease. It's one that you cannot, shall we say, overcome by cooking, which is not the case if you had, for example, E. coli. You just have to cook the burger more. But you also noted that dairy cows make up a really small percentage of our meat supply. It's only about 18% of all the beef and veal production comes from dairy cows. So in terms of the impact of dairy cows entering into our food supply, and dairy cows are generally older, so they're more likely if there were, the concern is that if you have an animal that has BSE, it's more likely to appear in older animals. But ultimately, this was just one dairy cow. We've only had 4 cases in the United States that we've ever, shall we say, caught. And it seems like it's a pretty small risk compared to, for example, the UK, which had a much larger concern over mad cow disease.
I'm trying to remember exactly where I read this, but it was in more than one place. Only about 1% of the meat that is sold in the United States is actually inspected. To the average person, that doesn't sound like much. Is that enough to determine if there's going to be a problem or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a random sample. So this is the justification from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But you're absolutely right. It's less than 1%. It's about 40,000 cows a year are sampled for mad cow disease. It depends on, I guess, where you fall on the spectrum. There are some that would argue we need to increase. Quite frankly, 1% is an increase over what we used to do. We increased in the 2000s. We began testing more for mad cow disease. But generally, assuming it's a random sample, that ideally you're capturing a good representation of what our food system would look like. And of course, if we increase sampling, that increased cost, which is another issue related to sort of striking the balance of a food safety system, but also an affordable food system.
I always like to try and give as much context as we can, and my academic background is in history, so I tend to favor that approach. And I want to bring Professor Wienders in on this because you've written extensively about the role of the government in agricultural policy and the agricultural economy of the nation. The food system that we have now in 2012, no one in, say, 1912 would recognize it because it's changed so dramatically, even over the last 40 years. And how much has government policy shaped the development of the industry of agriculture in the United States?
That's a really good question, John. And what I would say is it's had a very significant influence. So my research tends to be on agricultural policy, and specifically supply management policy in the 20th century in the U.S., which involved three main programs: price supports, which were basically artificially higher prices and subsidies for farmers; production controls, which limited the acreage that they could grow those crops on; and then export subsidies, which sent some of the food abroad below market cost. And if you just look at two foods that have caught a lot of attention recently, meat, which obviously we've started the discussion with, but also corn, you can see the way in which supply management policy helped to shape agricultural production in a way that contributed to the food system we have today. So one of the things that supply management did, ironically, was to contribute to increased production, and for some commodities like wheat, even an overproduction. And as the amount of corn produced in the United States, I should say the amount of corn and soybeans produced in the United States, increased after World War II, one of the outlets, the main outlet for the growing supply of corn and soybeans was the meat industry, going into livestock feed, these different crops. And meat consumption increased significantly between about 1945 and 1970, and then kind of leveled off. But just at the moment when, one of the ways in which supply management contributed to our food system was helping to fuel the expansion of the meat industry and helping to create a context in which industrial meat production was possible. And then when per capita meat production, or consumption rather, leveled off in the 1970s, then that's the exact moment that processed foods containing things like corn syrup and a variety of other corn products just took off. And so that became the second outlet for all of this corn, that corn and soybeans that were being produced in the United States. So the industrial food production that we have obviously isn't solely a consequence of agricultural policy, but the agricultural policy that we developed in the 1930s helped to fuel it and set up a context in which this food system was possible.
This food system is going back to the meat question, it's pretty different. I mean, from what, say, we even had in the 60s and maybe even the early 70s, where you had dozens of regional beef producers, and I'm talking about the slaughterhouses and the meatpacking companies, not necessarily the ranchers and farmers who actually raise the animals. But you had dozens and dozens all across the country of companies that bought and slaughtered meat animals for the table. Now, at least in the beef industry, we're down to three, and they produce thousands and thousands of carcasses a day, and the nature of the work has changed. The nature of the workers has changed. Some are suggesting that this is a reason why we have a bigger problem, for example, with E. coli in our beef, that we didn't used to have this trouble when production was on a smaller scale. And Professor Ransom, I want to go to you first on this. The changes in the in farming and in the production of meat for the dinner table, the changes there, have they improved safety or not?
It's not a yes or no question. It's complex. You're exactly correct. We have had an increase in concentration and vertical integration in the meat sector. We now have effectively, this is actually an old statistic, but back in 1996, approximately 80% of all cattle slaughtered that went to the marketplace, actually that slaughtering happened in only 22 plants in the United States. And so what you see happening is with this increased concentration, with fewer plants, with more animals being slaughtered, I think it's something like 95,000 cattle a day are slaughtered throughout the United States, you effectively have the possibility for it only taking a very small or even one animal that's contaminated to contaminate a much larger quantity of meat. And so it's not that our food is less safe. Some people would argue the concentration allows for more safety controls, but the problem is when you only have one problem, it contributes to a bigger recall, and that's exactly what we've seen. U.S. policies for food safety, we've made it mandatory that all meat slaughtering facilities are now HACCP compliant, and I can go into that if you want, but HACCP, effectively, after HACCP was implemented, we saw, again, a decrease in the number of small facilities and an increase in the number of large slaughtering facilities. And ever since HACCP has gone into effect, we've seen larger meat recalls than we've ever seen in the history of the United States.
Let's talk about who actually is paying attention to these issues in terms of enforcement of the rules that are on the books. You have the United States Department of Agriculture, which is a federal agency, I believe, established in the 19th century, and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, also has some role in food safety. And I want each of you to respond to this. We'll start with Professor Wienders. What are the roles, how do you see the roles of these two agencies, and how have they changed over time, do you think?
Well, I'll focus on the USDA, you know, as it relates to the work that I've done. And one of the things that the USDA has done over time is to engage in a lot of research, right? So research to make not only agricultural production more efficient and more scientific. That was one of the main functions it had in the early 1900s. But also, again, in the middle of the 20th century, the USDA began to engage in a lot of research and support a lot of research to find different uses for things like corn and soybeans to help develop techniques to make food, both food production and meat production, more, I guess, scientific or more efficient. As to the inspections, the inspection roles in the USDA versus the FDA, Elizabeth would be able to speak to that much better than I would, so I'll defer to her on that point.
Is Professor Ransom?
Yes. Well, the two main agencies that oversee our food system are the FDA and the USDA, but there are actually 15 agencies in total that administer food safety regulations. So we have approximately 30 laws related to food safety. So there's a lot of, shall we say, there's a lot of breakdown or duplication across departments. Generally, the general rule is that USDA oversees the food system up to the farm gate, and then the FDA takes over, you know, from the farm gate beyond. But there's a lot of examples where that doesn't actually fully apply. For example, cooked sausages, or in the case of drugs, FDA regulates the types of drugs that can be administered to animals. So there's a lot of sort of variance. But generally, the USDA oversees most of our meat production in the U.S. in terms of regulating it. And slaughter facilities, all slaughter facilities regulate, they stipulate that the meat has to have been approved, inspected by USDA prior to sell. Whereas in the case of FDA, some foods can actually go to the marketplace without needing to be, quote-unquote, inspected by FDA. So this has all led to a conversation of the need to sort of overhaul our food safety system in the U.S. And there are other countries who have done just that. Australia is a good example, but also Canada. They've moved to a food safety agency as opposed to what we currently have, which is a lot of agencies working on food safety, but no sort of centralized authority.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have some callers who want to join us. We have a Facebook comment that I'll share. Still room for you if you'd like to get in on our discussion. We're talking right now, we've been talking about food safety, but we're also talking about kind of the food industry in general. How does that food get from the farm to your plate? What happens to it and why? What are the policies in place that have caused us to have the food system we have now? You know, is that good or bad? I don't know if it is or not, and that's not my place to say in any event. But wondering what you think about it and what questions you have for my guests. We have a pair of experts with us this morning to talk about this. Bill Wienders is Associate Professor of Sociology at Georgia Tech University, and Elizabeth Ransom is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Richmond. 800-642-1234 is the phone number. 800-642-1234 is the phone number to use. It's good just about anywhere you can hear the program, although I'm told it does not work in Australia. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, talk at WPR.org. And you can also find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show page. Leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. 23 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up later today, after 3, join Ben Marins and his guest as they discuss a new study about teen driving. The study found teen girls are more likely to use electronic devices behind the wheel than boys. And it's not just talking and texting behind the wheel that causes distractions. That's on At Issue with Ben Marins after 3 o'clock today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about our nation's food supply. Most of us, I don't know, I mean, maybe you think more about these things than I do. Sometimes I wonder about it. I did spend some time, truth in advertising here, I did spend some time in an earlier part of my career working in the retail end of the food chain, and so I got to know meat cutters and others pretty well and find out about how things were done then. Things are certainly different now. But the recent mad cow incident in California, one dairy cow was found to have the mad cow disease, just got us thinking about food safety in general and also about our food system here in the U.S. and how it works and maybe some of the details and maybe some explanations of why things are the way they are. So two guests we have with us. Bill Wienders, Associate Professor of Sociology at Georgia Tech University, and Elizabeth Ransom, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Richmond. We have a Facebook comment from Michael, and I want to use this as a bridge to a phone call from Josie in Sheboygan because they're about kind of about the same thing. Michael wants us to talk about chickens, and I did have that on my list, Michael, so I wasn't ignoring it. We started out talking about beef, but there's certainly some issues surrounding poultry. Michael comments, a recent media report says that new USDA inspection rules would allow the plant to inspect the chickens and will ramp up the process to 3 seconds to check for disease. This would actually cause less federal inspection. He wants us to talk about that, and I think that dovetails nicely with what Josie in Sheboygan wants to talk about. So let's take that call now. Josie, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm bringing up the cruelty factor in all of this, and it's over the top with these factory farms. There's no way that they can check out all the diseases that can happen with all these poor animals that are clustered together. They can't even turn around. It was just in the news the other day that Burger King, it's going to take 5 years for them to allow these poor pigs to be in bigger, they can't even turn around. They just keep having little piglets over and over. I mean, it's just so horrendous. And then with the chickens, I mentioned that because they're in battery-sized cages one on top of each other, and they urinate and defecate on top of each other. They can't help it because they can't move, and that's where they live 24/7. Nobody seems to bring that up. I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. When you have those kind of conditions and then all the runoff and everything, why we don't have, why these diseases are more prevalent, and you have 1% being checked. I mean, it's just insane, in my opinion.
All right, Josie, thanks for the call. I think I want to go to Professor Ransom on this first. What about the poultry industry in the United States? Do we have some problems here?
Well, Josie brings up great points regarding animal welfare, and they somewhat link with your Facebook comment, but they're also somewhat unrelated. In terms of the animal welfare, agricultural animal welfare, there is actually a movement, shall we say, happening, and a part of it is consumer-driven. It's people like Josie who are not happy with the current state of our industrial agricultural systems. And so increasingly, while much of industry, shall we say, was resistant, increasingly industry, including poultry, but particularly the egg industry, has started focusing on improving animal welfare standards. And this is also occurring because this is happening in Europe. Europe has passed a lot of regulations trying to improve the state of animal welfare in their agricultural systems. And so there's sort of, shall we say, an increasing movement globally to pay more attention to the factory farms and the ways in which factory farming is inhumane for sentient beings. So there's that part, and certainly there are plenty of people out there that would argue that if you treat animals better, but I would add if you treat the workers better, you will decrease the amount of food safety problems in our system.
Let's talk about how the workers are treated in the food safety industry. I mean, there have been a number of horror stories that have been in the news over the last decade. A poultry processing plant where there was a fire, the doors were locked so the workers couldn't get out, that kind of thing. There have been a number of there was an incident where a meatpacking plant was raided by the INS, and a lot of undocumented workers were found to be there and so forth. Are these isolated incidents? What are the working conditions like in that industry?
Well, what we've seen is a transformation in the industry. Generally, the industry is very low-skilled work, and we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of Hispanic and Asian people that are working in this industry. And as we've seen the shift, we've also seen that most of the Hispanic and Asian population that's now working in these meatpacking plants are foreign-born and generally have less than a high school education. And so the reason I'm giving you that all that information is what I'm suggesting here is that you have a lot of workers working in meat slaughtering facilities who generally have not a lot of power, either in terms of economical, like they don't have a lot of choices in terms of their jobs or in terms of their legal status. And this is also coincided with a decline in the number of workers that are covered by unions. And ultimately, working in a meatpacking plant is dangerous. If you want to tune into those issues, there's really not a month that doesn't go by that there's not a reported death at a meatpacking plant. So you really have some low-end workers working on the line. And again, this is where many people have argued if you want to see an improvement in food safety, then that means we have to actually pay workers a fairer wage and empower them to speak up when they see a problem. And currently, the sort of prevailing view is that most workers don't have a lot of authority or ability to speak up within meat processing plants.
And I was going to say, to Michael's point, that the plants are going to be doing their own inspections under new USDA rules. Is that the case?
Well, you know, I'm not sure exactly what new regulation he's referring to. I would argue whatever he's referencing is a part of a bigger trend, and that really began in the 90s with HACCP. And HACCP is an acronym. It stands for Hazard Analysis Critical Control Points. But effectively, with the policy implemented in the U.S., that they made it a law that every meat processing plant has to have a HACCP plan. And HACCP effectively shifted regulation of the factory from being strictly government-regulated to being more regulated by the company. HACCP is where they sit there and they take tests, they monitor the line, and they create a whole sort of system of records that then the government regulators come in and basically look at the records. They don't necessarily go about the plant and look at the plant as much as they analyze the company's records. So what he's referencing is as part of a larger sort of plan that's been being put in place for almost two decades now.
Well, Professor Wienders, I want to follow up with you on a related topic. It's not just the meat supply that's been questioned in recent years. We had E. coli connected to broccoli and other crops that we buy in the store that come in, you know, fresh. We buy them in the produce aisle. And problems with peanut butter being contaminated and so forth. Talk about that side of it a little bit, because that's more your thing. And maybe compare it to what we see in the meat industry.
Well, it's tough for me to talk about safety. I'll talk about it a little bit, but Elizabeth may have more to say about even the fruits and the vegetables and peanuts that have come up with E. coli or other diseases. Is that rather than comparing it to the meat industry, I think I might try and link it in that there are some instances, for example, I think there was a spinach instance a few years ago where when fresh vegetables get E. coli, it's often related to them being not washed properly, but also being watered with, as they're growing, watered with water that has been contaminated to one degree or another by the industrial meat system, that is, by the industrial meat production. So having all of these animals, cows or chickens or pigs or whatever, concentrated in a small area obviously produces a lot of waste, especially if it's near feedlots. And to the extent that that waste contaminates groundwater or rivers or anything else, then it puts other aspects or other sectors of agriculture in jeopardy in those respects.
All right, let's take a call, and we'll go to Belvinville and hear from George. George, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment. We're a small grass-based farm here in the western side of Wisconsin. And, you know, to look at some solutions for these issues is, you know, our customers come to our farm. They inspect our farm. They're welcome there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year to see how our animals are raised. We are on the meat end of it. We do a meat CSA where our customers buy shares in our farm. Mm-hmm. And I think moving to that, a human scale would be a way, not only in meat, but also in vegetables, to get a closer inspection. We can inspect our chickens when we're butchering them as long as necessary. And it could eliminate some of these problems of scale.
Thanks for the call, George. Elizabeth, why don't we start with you on that one? And then I'd like to use that as a way to maybe launch into some of the local food movements that we've seen and just get your views on that, about trying to raise our food closer to the places where it's being consumed. But to George's point about his farm and the way he operates.
Yeah, George, I'm so glad he called in. I would actually probably like to ask him a few questions. George mentioned he's small, and I think this is a key component to our current food system, is what we've seen happening in the United States is what they call the disappearing middle. We've seen, shall we say, a proliferation of small farms, and they're usually not farms that are 100% reliant on income from the farm. And we've seen the growth of really large farms, especially when in the meat industry. It's get big or get out. And what we've seen really the loss of are what we call the middle-sized farmer, that farmer that is trying to make a living being a farmer but doesn't want to be a massive farmer, meaning doesn't want to have 100,000 cattle in their feedlot or 50,000 heads of cattle. And so this is where sort of the problem lies, is how do we try and secure the mid-scale farm. George, absolutely correct. There's the growth of CSAs, which generally is a community supporting local farmers. But again, these generally are smaller scale farmers. And it does come back to an issue of price, although a lot of people argue this is an artificial argument, that if you had enough CSAs, then the price would come down. But currently, to be a CSA member is not as affordable as it is to go to your local grocery store. And of course, this is because in our current industry, a lot of people argue that industrialized system is artificially cheap, meaning it doesn't factor in all the costs that are really there. But it is, at this moment in time, more affordable for a family to go to a local grocery store than it is to go and join a local either CSA or go to a farmer's market. But that could change depending on the number of people participating.
Well, Professor Wienders, I want to come to you on this point because you've said that because we have not properly managed supply, this has had a direct effect on food prices, and you relate that to poverty, that the people in poverty are paying a much higher percentage of their income in food, and so when things change, they notice it first, and some of the rest of us don't really pay much attention to what food costs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. As Elizabeth said, the large industrial food system that we have in many ways is subsidized. So at the very basic level, I think at least in the 1990s, and I would expect it to be the same today, but in the 1990s, I know that it was about 15% of farmers receiving about 85% of all farm subsidies. So the subsidies were going to a relatively concentrated number of farmers that helped the fuel really over the long haul from the mid-20th century on through today, that helped to fuel the kind of concentration in agriculture that Elizabeth was talking about. And as a result, since not only it's subsidized, but it helps to spur increased production and increased use of technology and increased use of machinery, all of which, again, subsidized by the federal government, but then helps to take advantage of economies of scale and have a lower price, then it makes, you know, food that's come, fruits and vegetables, processed foods that are made with grains or corns, et cetera, helps to make all of that much cheaper than a very small farmer like George might be able to do.
Well, and we want, when we go to the grocery store, you know, we like cheaper. I mean, we don't want to have to spend more. And food manufacturers have gone to great lengths, seemingly, to make it seem like we're not spending more. By, for example, the 2-pound can of coffee doesn't exist. It's 24 ounces. You know, that kind of thing, where the price stays the same, but the contents of the package goes down. We see these big boxes of cereal, for example, that only contain a few ounces of cereal compared to, say, what that box might have contained in, say, 1970. As consumers, we want it cheap, and we want to have it year-round, and we've gotten kind of spoiled. What would happen if we actually had to pay the real cost of food, you think?
You know, to go back to the first part of your question, I think that, or one, the part of your earlier question that I didn't answer is about food prices and income and poverty. And I think that if prices reflected more closely the overall cost of food, that the people who would really feel it most are people whose income in the United States, who are on the lower income levels, whose food expenditures represent a larger portion of their household incomes. So on average, probably less than 10% of the average household income in the United States goes towards foods. But as that income shrinks, the amount of money spent on food is something that's hard to change, right? Whereas we can cut back on other things, luxury items or other things that may seem not to be quite luxury, but still not quite as basic as food, right? So we can cut back on gasoline. We can cut back on going to the movies or going out to eat. But in terms of the amount of food that we have to buy and prepare from the supermarket, it's a relatively stable amount. And so if the overall income in a household's lower, they're going to really feel any increase in the price of food. And this was true in 2008. So the USDA found that the number of food insecure homes, these are homes where the householders are not necessarily sure where there's different levels of food insecurity, but not necessarily sure where their next meal is coming from, or that they aren't able to purchase what would be deemed an adequately nutritious diet. That food insecure homes in the United States increased in 2008, and that's the exact moment when world food prices, especially for wheat and rice, increased significantly. And it, of course, had effects not only in the United States, but around the world.
And, of course, this is a tremendously complex question, as I believe you've both pointed out. And that's one of the problems with trying to do a show like this in an hour is there are so many different variables. For example, the role of speculation in the price of commodities could be an entire program in and of itself. I was wondering, Professor Ransom, if you wanted to comment a little bit on the actual cost of what we produce in the meat industry, as opposed to, for example, if you want to buy some a piece of meat that comes from a grass fed animal, as opposed to one fed corn, it costs a lot more. The cost of production, if we don't just put these animals in feedlots and feed them with corn, goes up quite a bit, doesn't it? And are we as consumers prepared to actually pay the price for that kind of meat?
Well, definitely the price goes up, but many people would argue you're actually paying the real price of production as opposed to beef or poultry coming out of industrialized systems, because industrialized systems, they work on economies of scale, and oftentimes what's not factored into that are the use of natural resources and the pollution of natural resources. So moving to, shall we say, more grass-fed system, definitely you'll see an increase in price. But I think what you really have to point out, there's two issues. One is the United States is one of the largest consumers of meat in the world. And so many people would argue that we actually have to, in general, as a population, decrease the amount we're eating. We simply can't sustain this long term. But the other issue is the amount of concentration. And we've seen a dramatic increase in concentration throughout the food chain. This goes all the way from the point of like farm products, like who buys wheat, for example. Three companies control approximately, I think it's 70 to 80% of all wheat globally. But it's also of meat. It's also in the retail sector. The United States has been slow. Europe is more concentrated, but we are quickly gaining. I believe it's now our largest retailer in the United States now has over 50% of the market. And so there's, as you know, a lot of dynamics at work here in terms of when we talk about price of food. And I think we have to be very critical when we talk about price to be aware of the very few number of actors that actually are participating in setting that price, in addition to all the things that aren't getting factored into the cost of that production.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we have a number of people who want to talk on the phone with us, and we'll let them do just that in just a moment. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of WPR. 10:46, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller is in after 11, and he visits with an old friend and audience favorite to talk about what the challenges and opportunities are for science in our society, plus information on a great summer science event. That's Larry Mueller's program after 11 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about our food supply. Is it safe? How much does it cost? Why does it cost that much? What are the factors involved? How did we get here? Actually, too many things to talk about in an hour, but we're giving it our best shot. A lot of people want to join us on the phone. Let's go to, let me reintroduce my guests first. That would probably be a better idea if I was to do that. I have with me Professor Bill Winders, professor of sociology at Georgia Tech University, author of The Politics of Food Supply, U.S. Agricultural Policy and the World Economy, and Elizabeth Ransom, associate professor of sociology at the University of Richmond. All right, to the phones we go, and West Bend will be our first stop. We'll hear from Paul. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Could you discuss where we are, both government-wise and research institutions, as far as either pure research and applied research, is the creation of synthetic meat tissue? In other words, on a molecular level, it would be identical to a portion, say, of a beef cattle. In other words, are we concentrating on putting the dollars in to develop this, because if you could create, you know, have a matrix where you could grow meat tissue without having a central nervous system or a cortex, you would, all sorts of issues go away. The question is, can you have an economy of scale where you've got a manufacturing facility where you can grow this? Where are we? Are we putting major dollars in there? We got to the moon. I think we could actually create this a system where you're actually creating meat at the same molecular level as like something walking around on four roads.
Who wants to take that one? Elizabeth, you want to start?
Sure, I'm happy to. It sounds like Paul has a bit of a science background, and I will do the disclaimer of I'm not an animal scientist, but I have read quite a bit on this. And I think, first of all, I'll say yes, the research is out there. They're doing it. I actually recently, I think it's been this year, read a report where they have successfully produced some meat substitute or meat, shall we say, it is meat, but meat out of in the lab, not, you know, off the animal. But I think the bigger issue here is one about consumer acceptance. And I think you can't avoid that question of it's fine if we can do it, because I think, quite frankly, scientifically speaking, we could probably do it. It's whether or not the vast majority of consumers would be willing to eat that. And so that's where I think we have a long way to go, because in order to get consumers to want to eat it, they have to, A, think it's safe, and B, make it look appetizing. And so those are all sort of, I think, significant hurdles that the research has not quite tackled yet.
And Professor Winters, do you want to get in on this, or should we take another call?
I would just say that Elizabeth got it exactly right. I think that the real issue is going to be about the public's reaction. And, well, I'll just leave it at that.
Well, that would certainly be the case, I would think. I mean, look what happened with this whole pink slime thing. I mean, people went kind of nuts about that. And, you know, that's still a question being talked about. So we do respond when there's news about food. We're pretty touchy about the food supply, even though we don't pay a whole lot of attention to how it all works. Let's go to Warren, Illinois next and hear from Matthew. Matthew, good morning. Hi, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I want to start by saying that your guests are fantastic, and they've been covering a lot of the very important points. I want to just go a little further. One of your speakers mentioned how this legislation that was supposed to make things safer ended up just forcing out some of the mid-sized slaughterhouses. A lot of these legislations are written with the help of industry, and they target it to say, well, you know, if you want to wash your hands, for example, this is something that happened in Poland, you need an automatic sink with an automatic faucet so that you don't get blood on the faucet. And by forcing small operations to try to put in these fancy infrared-operated sinks, they went out of business. And it sounds like it's there to help safety, but in the end, it was there to restrict the smaller operations, which then gave more power to the larger companies that then took over and then started saying, well, we're not going to buy pigs from the people that they bought pigs from. We're only going to buy pigs from people that we have contracts with. And they compartmentalized the market by doing that. Another couple problems real quick. I'm a president of a nonprofit group that opposes factory farming and has had to try to move into our neighborhood and force out our family farmers. So I've been reading a lot about this the last 4 or 5 years. On the mad cow issue, dairy industry is being beaten up right now. It's very hard on family farmers, especially in Wisconsin. If you have a cow that is showing signs of mad cow disease or is stumbling around, those cows don't often make it to the slaughterhouses where they would then be seen by government inspectors. They're euthanized before they can go to market, because if there was a rumor that there were more mad cows around, it would cause tremendous problems, not only to that individual farmer, but to the industry on a whole. So I don't know if I trust the inspections the way they're being done right now.
Well, let's focus on the first point you made about the regulations doing in the middle-sized packing plants. And I think, Professor Ransom, you alluded to this earlier, but if you want to follow up on what Matthew had to say there.
Sure. Actually, Matthew brings up a lot of great points. I was nodding my head as he was saying all of this, because we haven't really touched very much on the dairy industry, which is a slightly different industry compared to meat products that we would consume. But going with the legislation, absolutely. This has long been a critique of regulations, especially government regulations that get constructed with consultation with industry, is that it's all about how the regulations get set and who gets excluded. And actually, it's I think Bill can speak to historically at the turn of the century a similar sort of a similar set of issues occurred when they were passing the first sort of food safety inspection laws. It was basically big industry who joined with government and said, yes, we want this. And they did want it, but they recognized it was good for sales, but they also recognized it would be a great way to eliminate some competition. And I think that's always the struggle of trying to strike that balance between regulation, but not regulation that will purposely leave out a certain group of people.
Professor Winders, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I would just agree that Matthew brings up a lot of good points, and the issue of regulation and market concentration is, you know, those are two things that have indeed gone hand in hand for at least a century, if not, you know, two centuries in the United States. And as Elizabeth said, it certainly was something that was present when the FDA was created in the early 1900s as big meat packers were looking to ship to Europe, which had put restrictions on U.S. imports coming into Europe because we didn't have the same level of standards in terms of meat inspections. And to try and compete, to try and reduce the competitive advantage that only domestic and smaller producers would have, smaller producers aimed at the domestic market in the United States. The big companies said, well, let's make sure that, you know, it's federally funded and that the meat inspections, the standards apply to everyone, so that way they could still export to Europe and compete, be competitive in the U.S. domestic market against these smaller firms. And even if we go back to the issue that Josie raised earlier about cruelty in the chicken industry in particular, the chicken industry recently has begun to support the idea of having larger cages for chickens. And one of the complaints is that it will raise the cost of meat, but another is this issue of market concentration, that smaller producers will have more difficulty bearing the cost of the larger cages.
Okay.
The regulation definitely can have that effect.
I want to try and get in a couple more calls if we can. Might not be able to do it, but let's start with Colleen in Sharon. Colleen, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for your show. I appreciate it. It's a topic of interest to my family. I wanted to ask specifically about a video that we saw. There's lots of reasons that our family has really tried to get healthy for our baby, and we go grass-fed, locally produced beef. We go in with other families, and the price we're getting is okay. We're moderate income, and we're paying $2.79 a pound for all cuts off the beef, although the chicken is more expensive. One organic chicken costs us $15 to $17, but we've determined it's worth it. One of the things that pushed me over the edge particularly was the video Food Inc., and I wanted to ask your guest's opinion about its accuracy in general, if it is a good representation of some of the problems we have in the United States, or if it's more incendiary.
Wow. Okay. Professor Ransom, I think you want to respond to that one first.
Sure. I actually, it's one of my regular viewings from my students at the university. In many ways, it's a great portrayal, and it actually goes back to a point George, who called in, the small grass-based farmer, is that Food Inc. really shows the lack of transparency in our food system, and I think that's a real problem. If we had a more transparent food system, we could potentially have a much more open discussion about our food system. My only critique of Food Inc. is it really ends with the consumer being the person to try and create that change. And while certainly consumers have a key role, I think to simply place the burden of changing our food system on consumers is unfair and probably unrealistic. Food Inc. definitely captures many of these key issues that are sort of currently at play in industrialized agriculture in the United States.
And Professor Winders, to the well, and there we've We've only got about a minute left, and so I don't want to introduce any too many new topics. But again, the whole economy of scale thing that Colleen was bringing up about, you know, she's buying local and from local farmers and so forth. We don't all have that option. But how is government policy going to determine the winners and losers here?
Well, that's a very good question, and as with most of them, very complex. And it's especially complex because sometimes, you know, in terms of policy determining the winners or losers, you also have to understand what is it that's determining the policy. And sometimes the folks who end up being the winners are the ones who have the most influence. And it's a very vague answer to your question, but my point is that it's very difficult to change the agricultural policy and hence the food system that we have, in part because the most powerful actors today are the ones who tend to have the greatest say on policies that will shape the system going forward.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there, Professor, because we're out of time. But I really appreciate both of you helping to bring some focus to a kind of a squishy topic here. Bill Wienders, Associate Professor of Sociology at Georgia Tech, and Elizabeth Ransom, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Richmond. Thanks to both of you. This program was produced by Brent Jaspers, on-air production by Marika Suval. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.